Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. What an honor it is for me to be a guest in your community, to come and share my story of what it was like to stand shoulder to shoulder with our nation's highest leaders as the attack on our country was in progress. I want you all to know right up front, it took me 9 years to get permission to tell you this story. Finally, in 2010, the National Security Council allowed me to travel around and share this insightful story of what it was like that day at the highest levels of our government. I want to tell you right up front what I learned. We call it bottom line up front. America is a military superpower, there is no question. But the greatest strength our country has to offer, it's in its local communities, it's in our people. It's in people like you willing to stand up and run back into buildings, help complete strangers on the side of the road in need. Ordinary people who took their boats to drive across the Hudson River to evacuate people off Manhattan Island during the attack. We had shopkeepers and ferry boat captains and ordinary Canadians up even to the north to take our citizens home with them on that day. It was a horrible day, but it was a great day for me to see the true fabric of our nation in full swing. On 9/11/2001, 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked 4 aircraft, crashing 2 into the World Trade Center towers, 1 into the west side of our Pentagon, and 1 crash in the field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It was a day that these terrorists tried to destroy our nation, and instead all they did was unify us. They tried to instill fear in each one of us, and yet thousands of young men and women that you see here tonight got up, changed their life, went down to a recruiting station to join our ranks to defend our freedoms, to deploy around our country, to be part of the solution, to root out terrorism, and to serve this nation with all the muster and guts they can possibly have. And they did so brilliantly. 20 years ago, our country was attacked. Our freedoms were not shaken. Our buildings were shaken. Our buildings fell down. Our planes came out of the sky. But our democracy held. Our freedom held. Our military held. Our communities held. Our society has never been stronger. If you remember, hours after 9/11, every building in our country, every home, every mailbox was covered with red, white, and blue. We had a common purpose: defend America, defend patriotism and freedom in all forms. Come together to unite and put away your petty differences that really don't matter, and get online and toe the line and defend the United States of America against those who would destroy it. And that's what we did. Thank you, Lori Bishop, for allowing me to come here tonight to share a little bit, mostly about my story that day working in the White House Military Office, Airlift Operations Department. I was an attack helicopter pilot. I joined the Marine Corps in 1987. I deployed in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and in 1993, Somalia. And in 1998, I had the pleasure, the honor of flying President Bill Clinton around. When the Bushes came to office, President Laura Bush, I was invited to be a part of the White House Military Office, Airlift Operations Department. Our job in airlift operations is to support our president worldwide. What many of you probably don't know is our president only flies in Marine One, Air Force One. He's driven in our limousines, he speaks in our secure phones, he's seen by our doctor and fed food from our chef and military staff. We can't outrun Air Force One, so we got to pre-position that equipment. And on 9/11/2001, we pre-positioned it. We moved it to Sarasota, Florida. And while the president was executing his academic agenda, his education initiative, and the M.A. Booker Elementary School, we were behind the scenes making sure he had everything he needed to do his job. And then things changed. So here's what I'm going to ask of you tonight. I want you to have a mission that's twofold. We're going to remember. We're going to remember the 2,977 people we lost that instant, and we're also going to remember the nearly 3,000 Marines, airmen, sailors, and soldiers that we've lost since then, either to combat operations or non-combat fatalities. And we're also going to do this, the most important part. We're going to reinvigorate ourselves. We're going to stand up proud for what we accomplished since 9/11. The defense of our freedom and our patriotism cannot stop. The war on terrorism is not over. It is something that we must live and commit to every single day, or it'll come back to our shores in an instant. And we need each and every one of you to rededicate yourself to the purpose of being part of your community, support those military programs that we all come to know so well. Stand up and be a part of the solution moving forward, and leave this country to the next generation or two behind us as well as we protected it to this point in our history. So let's dive in. Let me tell you my story. At the end, we'll have a chance to reflect more about it. I want you to know, I showed up at the White House at 8 o'clock that morning, and the first thing we did was start monitoring the president's whereabouts in Sarasota, Florida. Two people in the U.S. government, just two, have the authority to give offensive, lethal authority to the U.S. military. Anyone can defend themselves. Well, if we're going to cross a border, wipe out an army, kill a terrorist, it better come from our national command authority. Our national command authority is made up of the President of the United States and our Secretary of Defense. The President was in the M.E. Booker Elementary School. Our Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, was eventually over at the Pentagon's National Military Command Center. Everyone else is in support of those two individuals. So we have the Vice President, he was in the White House, Dr. Rice, our National Security Advisor. We had General Shelton, United States Army, turning over his post as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to General Richard Myers, United States Air Force, current President of K-State University. He was on Capitol Hill that morning going through his confirmation process to become the next Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was in an acting role on 2001 on that infamous day. It's 8:46. I'm in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, fourth floor, monitoring the president's schedule when someone came running in and said, "Major, turn on the TV set. Apparently a small airplane just struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center complex." Like many of you, we went to the TVs. We turned it on. I'm looking at that first photo up there. The first thing that came to mind was, why would a pilot careen into a 110-story landmark on such a clear blue crystal day? He literally had the Hudson River to his left, the East River to his right. Most of us could probably glide and reach LaGuardia Airport. There's much more to this story than we know. Phones start ringing off the hook. American Airlines Flight 11 departed out of Boston Logan Airport on its way out to California. Ultimately went lost communications over Albany, New York, down the Hudson River at over 500 miles an hour, into our North Tower at 8:46. While the world watched, to include all of us in airlift operations, we saw United Airlines Flight 175 come into view. I remember yelling up at the TV set going, "Hey, what's this moron doing? Trying to get a look at the hole in the North Tower before he circles to land at LaGuardia Airport." We watched it careen into our South Tower at what looked like full power to us. It was at that very moment that my boss, he was an Air Force, full bird colonel, he came into airlift operations. He told us all to stop what we were doing. Eyeballs on him. We have a full-blown terrorist event unfolding right before our eyes in the city of New York. Stand by. Stop what you're doing and stand by for a lot of White House-designated missions. And you'll say to yourself, well, what does that mean? Whenever we have a national tragedy in our country, all government agencies are full of expertise and resources, and they all have a role to play. And they end up all calling the Department of Defense for airlift support. But our DOD doesn't put one government agency in front of another. No one is more important than the next. You get put into what we call a queue. But if you call the White House and you go, "Mr. President, Mr. Chief of Staff, Mr. Vice President, this is FEMA. I have 75 doctors, all the medicines I can carry. I need to be on the ground up there in the city of New York." And the White House says, "Go." You become a one alpha one. We will push baby food out of the back of the next available C-17 Air Force heavy lift platform to get you and your people loaded up and flown to where the White House wants you to be. Now all these government agencies are calling into airlift operations. We're pushing it up to the Deputy White House Chief of Staff. He's going approved. 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 Now we're on the phone with the Pentagon telling them divert every Air Force heavy lift platform out of the sky. Get them on the ground at Joint Base Andrews 15 miles to the east. Do what we call rack them and stack them. Park them on the taxiways. Fill them full of gas. The White House wants everyone to New York City. There'll be a wave of people coming across Washington, D.C. Get up to New York as quick as possible. Just as we were doing that, and all of a sudden an airliner overflew the White House. This airliner was so large and so loud, you couldn't hear yourself think. The White House has prohibited airspace. If you're not a Marine One pilot, nobody overflies the White House ever. Somebody ran to the window and goes, holy mackerel, I saw a big white jet in a hard left-hand turn heading west. We have breaking news, fire and explosion over at the Pentagon. We don't have an attack on New York. We have an attack on the northeast quadrant of the United States. It elevated everything to the next level. We found out instantaneously that the Pentagon was on fire. It was attacked by American Airlines Flight 77, departed out of Dulles, Virginia, 30 miles to the west, went to Ohio, hijacked right back to Washington, D.C. It made a right-hand 360 over Reagan National Airport. That was not the airplane that just overflew the White House. If you remember back then, 20 years ago, the Air Force was doing a large military nuclear command and control exercise. We had one of our special aircraft, an E-4B, Air Force 747, weird cone on top. It's called the Doomsday Plane, the National Airborne Ops Center. It's the Flying Pentagon. That air crew, that airplane was on the ground in Andrews when the second tower was struck. They activated it and said, get to Sarasota, Florida as fast as you can go. When that 747 lifted off out of Andrews, it made a left-hand turn, put a laser line to Sarasota, and it flew right over the White House. That's what got Vice President Cheney picked up by his elbows by Secret Service and now rushed underground that day. The Pentagon was hit by American Airlines Flight 77, a 757. That hijacked 757 and this Air Force E-4B must have passed each other in flight as one was racing to the president and one was careening into the west side of our Pentagon. Just then, as you can imagine, all the loudspeakers blared to life. For the second time in American history, the White House was ordered evacuated. The first time was during the War of 1812, when in February of 1814, the British were burning down Washington, D.C., and Dolly Madison ran out the back door of the White House carrying a print of George Washington. Here it is 187 years later, we're evacuating our White House for the second time in history. That colonel came in and said, that's it, we're out of here. Everybody to the alternate site. I stopped him and said, sir, I can't go. President Bush is not coming back to Washington, D.C. We got the Pentagon on fire, smoke over the White House, wherever they're going to take him today. He needs limousines, snipers, doctors. He needs the presidential package. He said, go across the street, go underground in the President's Emergency Operations Center and do logistics. The rest of us are out of here. As I got to the top of the steps, I'm now looking over at the White House. I got my planning kit. I had to pause just for a moment because the White House is probably the most secure piece of real estate in the world. And on 9/11, they had the gates to the north wide open. The gates to the south were wide open. Every Secret Service agent had an automatic weapon, and they were yelling to the people that worked there, ladies, take off your heels and run. There's another plane inbound. Watching these American professional staffers working at the White House, 20, 30, 40, 50-year-olds, dropping their backpacks, their purses, kicking off their shoes, running off the most secure piece of real estate in the world. Just an unbelievable sight. I got across the street, showed my credentials. Secret Service lets me in. I'm underground. I'm standing before a door you and I don't pull on. It's a bank vault on steroids. I picked up the phone. I request permission to enter. The door opens. The door closes. You're inside the President's Emergency Operations Center, deep under the White House. I can't tell you how thick the walls are, how deep it is underground, but I can tell you it exists. It was built back in the 60s, a nuclear-hardened facility. It gives us a safe place to take the first family in times of national tragedy. It's now going to become the main hub of operations on September 11, 2001. When I walked into this bunker complex, try to imagine these military members doing their job, answering the phones, taking notes, typing away on their computers. Our job in the military is situational awareness for the president, and that's what these folks were doing. Get the information, get it corroborated, and circulated up to the highest levels of our government that day. The first person I saw was a mill aide for Vice President Cheney, a good friend of mine. I said, "Tom, I'm here to do logistics. I'll stay out of your way." He said, "Bob, forget logistics. I need your help. Answer the phones. They're ringing off the hook." Try to imagine the chaos. I could hear people on the phone. I can see an empty desk. I moved towards it. The phone was ringing. I naturally dropped my planning kit and I picked up the phone. It's now 7 minutes after the White House was ordered evacuated when I received my first phone call that day, deep underground at the White House. It was a Situation Room now calling downstairs into the bunker complex to tell me, "Major, we have another hijacked aircraft 16 miles south of Pittsburgh, inbound Washington, D.C. As you can imagine, I said, "Whoa, you're going to have to hold on." I turned to my right to tell Tom, the mill aide, who's standing next to me, but Vice President Cheney. Behind him was his wife, Lynn. Here comes Dr. Rice, our national security advisor. Her deputy, Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation. Everyone who was upstairs is now downstairs in this bunker complex, coming over to my phone. I snapped to, "Mr. Vice President, sir, 16 miles south of Pittsburgh, we have another one coming at us." He turned away from me. Up on the wall down there are these three black boxes. They're landlines, they're speaker boxes. He can be patched through to whoever he wants to talk to. The first person he asked for was the Herndon, Virginia Command Center for the FAA. The supervisor's name was Rick. He came up on the network. He goes, "Mr. Vice President, that aircraft is not talking. It's not squawking a transponder code, giving our air traffic controllers airspeed, altitude, and direction information. It's way off course. So that's a hijacked aircraft." He turned to the second speaker box. "Hey, Don, are you up?" He's looking for the Secretary of Defense, the other member of our national command authority who can give our pilots the rules of engagement we need to defend America. Secretary Rumsfeld is not there. They entered his office at 8:46 and said, "Mr. Secretary, we need you downstairs." He said, "Listen, I'm going to keep with my daily schedule. Keep me apprised of what's going on." They re-entered his office at 9:03 with the South Tower attack. And he said, "Keep me apprised of what's going on. I'm due for a CIA briefing in 2 minutes. At 9:37, his desk literally shook with the impact of Flight 77. He got up out of his office chair. He ran outside to assist with the evacuation of the wounded. A pretty admirable thing to do, but not really his appointed place of duty. We got a president trying to get airborne. We got a Secretary of Defense lost in the parking lot. We have nobody at the helm of our national military command and control structure to tell our pilots what the rules of engagement is. Just then, Vice President Cheney, talking to a one-star general, said, "General, I want you to listen to me. I want two F-15s. I want them at Otis Air National Guard Base. Let me know when they're airborne. Stand by to shoot this aircraft down." I remember I covered the receiver. I turned to my right to stare at the Vice President. My 14 years in the Marine Corps told me my job is options for the president. We just unleashed the United States Air Force to take lethal action against a civilian airliner. It was at that moment that my heightened situational awareness just rose two notches. I'm not talking to an ordinary politician. I'm talking to a congressman from Wyoming, a chief of staff for President Ford, a secretary of defense for the first President Bush, and now Vice President of the United States. He wrote those war plans. He didn't say, "Get me fighters." He knew we had F-15s on alert at Otis, F-16s in Langley, Virginia, F-18s in Jacksonville, Florida. It turns out we couldn't have had a better crisis leader at that moment in history to get our country moving forward. We heard immediately after F-15s were airborne, they're supersonic over Long Island, New York. That's 1,200 miles per hour. Closing in on United Flight 93. They wanted to be confirmed, weapons free to engage. And without hesitation, Vice President Cheney said, "You are weapons free. Shoot that aircraft down." As you can imagine, the room went silent. We got a real world military mission in progress. All eyes on the Vice President staring at those three speaker boxes when all of a sudden, all the satellite radios blared to life. Aircraft down. Aircraft down. 68 miles south of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. No survivors. We thought on orders from the Vice President to the U.S. military, we just took lethal action against United Flight 93. Just then, Vice President Cheney turned around. He walked right over to me and he goes, "Major, for the congressional investigation, state your full name." And I got to be honest with you. You know what I was thinking? I was thinking, no. I don't know if now's a good time to tell you this, Mr. Vice President, but I'm here to do logistics. But I snapped too. I raised my game. I put my heels together. Mr. Vice President, it's Major Bob Darling. He goes from Major Darling to the Vice President to the National Military Command Center. We just shot that plane down. I really need to talk to the President. Just then, everybody's going, "Air Force One, Air Force One, this is the PEOC." And as we were trying to reach the President, those same satellite radios blared to life. The F-15s never fired. The F-15s never fired. My first look into the greatness of America when I heard that 40 ordinary Americans boarded that aircraft in Newark, New Jersey, on their way to San Francisco, California, talking to loved ones. They learned three planes, three targets. We're not going to Cuba. This is not a ransom mission. We fight or we die. And these ordinary Americans united themselves. Tom Burnett, Todd Beamer, 38 others came up with a plan. Based on the FAA tapes, we know that they got into the cockpit, hands-on terrorist. Ultimately, that plane rolled completely upside down and hit straight down in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. When the FBI went to Shanksville, they found the last piece of aircraft 40 feet in the dirt. That's how hard that plane hit the ground. These ordinary Americans rose up to do extraordinary things, not just to save themselves, but to keep these terrorists from reaching their goal of striking the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. You see, the ultimate mission was for these terrorists to strike our financial capital in New York, our military capital at the Pentagon, and our ultimate capital in Washington, D.C. And these heroes, these ordinary people, these Americans, true patriots, had something to say about that. It was an eye-opening event for everyone.